oh my God, I'm going to be on a real professional radio station. 48% weekly reach, that was such a high feeling, that was amazing. Somebody once said to me that all it takes to run a radio station is five people who get it.
Conversations, an occasional radio moment series in which we talk to those who made a difference. Chris Carnegie.
Back then, Terry Wogan on Radio 2 was the thing the whole family could agree on. We all had that on in the background as Dad got off to work and me and my sister got off to school and so on and, you know, enjoyed the banter.
Today, it's a sort of a two-way ceremony. The sun is coming down from the sky, which is a big surprise if it came off from the pavements.
The other thing that I was a very early convert to as a kid was some of the comedy on Radio 4, or the kind of what you might call the light programmes. So to this day, when I hear Just a Minute, I can picture myself, you know, in a summer holiday on a hot day, maybe 1976 in that famous long hot summer. I can see the sort of melamine top of the kitchen table when I'd finished playing in the garden and come back for lunch, and there was Nicholas Parsons in the background.
Can you tell us something about that in this game, starting now?
It was mainly national and, in those days, of course, BBC radio that was my passive listening experience. But the other thing that really got me excited was the launch of LBC. I was growing up in the London suburbs, and suddenly I realised there was this different kind of radio, which, of course, was more immediate and more accessible, and the concept that radio news could be a format all of its own was fresh and new and really exciting to me then.
It is well known that the Labour Party have opposed the introduction of commercial broadcasting, but that in no way prevents me from offering my best wishes to the independent broadcasting news service.
There are two sliding doors moments in my life that really have defined my career ever since. Number one was I was finishing my Saturday job at Ryman's, the stationer's, and got in the car, my little Hillman Imp, and forgot to put the cassette in the machine, which I would normally do because I didn't particularly like the Saturday evening show on Capital, which was my kind of driving listen in those days. And because I forgot to put the cassette in, I turned the machine on and there was the jock on Capital doing one of their community announcements advertising for hospital radio volunteers. So that led me to QMBS, the Queen Mary's Broadcasting Service in Roehampton in South London. The other sliding doors moment is actually about the journalistic side. I went to the school careers evening and put myself down for some generic sort of job talk about civil service or something like that. Got to the room, there was a notice on the door saying, "Terribly sorry, the speaker for this session is off sick. Go to any adjacent room." And I walked into the next door room, and there was the editor of the local paper talking about how, as a journalist, you had a license to go anywhere and ask any questions, and what a privilege that was. And that was a light bulb moment. So those two set me on the course for radio and the journalistic side. And then there was actually another one. I was on the way to an interview at Oxford University, for which I was completely unsuited, but I was even more unsuited by the time I got there, literally and metaphorically. My car overheated. When I went to take the cap off the radiator, I got sprayed with boiling oil because it had a dodgy head gasket. My suit was covered in boiling oil, so was I. Got to the interview, failed it, which I probably would have done anyway. The result was I ended up going to Southampton University, not Oxford. And of course, the big difference was Southampton had a student radio station and Oxford didn't. So all those sliding doors incidents, I can, in retrospect, plot them quite clearly as to how they got me involved in radio in the first place.
I love you because you understand it.
QMBS Hospital Radio was a great little station. It was physically tiny, up a rickety iron staircase behind the gym in what was a hospital which was famous for fake limb fitting after the Second World War and had then become a general hospital with a few specialities. And they had a call for volunteers. I went up those stairs, walked in, and it was almost the smell of the place. I swear to this day that, you know, stocks of vinyl records and reel-to-reel tape have a distinctive smell, and the lights glowing, the precision with which they opted out of Radio 2, played a back-timed signature tune.
But many happy returns today, and congratulations to the pair of you, Lynn and Doug.
I watched that happen, and the precision of it and the elegance of it just made me gasp, and I thought, oh, I need a piece of this. Fantastic. It was quite a well-run station. The station manager was a BBC engineer, Rob McKenzie. That's Rob McKenzie, who became a reporter on Capital, was doing his course at the London College of Printing then and was the kind of news bunny. The commercial producer from LBC, a man who became famous as a bit of a programming guru in ILR, Paul Easton, was the programme controller. He taught me to queue up a record, and we did a lot of stuff, you know, speech programming, of course the request shows, OBs from on the wards, great team spirit, but it was a great, great grounding. Southampton University had a station called Radio Glen. It broadcast only to one hall of residence called Glen Eyre. That was unusual, actually, but Southampton wasn't a campus university. We had a potential audience of 900 residents. I joined up enthusiastically. Unusually, I had a bit of radio background from the hospital days, and within the first term and a half got myself elected as the programme controller. And with a few other guys who were on the committee, we set about kind of reforming it, giving it a proper programme schedule, a sort of dependability, some programme standards. We built physically new studios. They even built the mixer themselves. And we sort of smartened it up, I suppose. Great, great memories. It's not unusual now, I think, but we did the sort of 24-hour marathon fundraisers for Rag Week, and jockeying for 24 hours when you have to queue up a vinyl record every 3 minutes is a big task. But, you know, we all tried it and we all survived it. Really happy memories. In fact, to this day, one of the half dozen when or where were you happiest moments that I can identify was a sort of Christmas party on the air we did in thick snow at the end of the first term of, I think, the second year of university, when it was just that feeling of being sort of high on the experience and the camaraderie and the feeling of being, you know, right at the heart of something. I think as a student programme controller, I was good. I'm going to be immodest about this. I made a point of, you know, giving every new contributor a proper training session. I'd run them through half a dozen links, and I'd climax the one-hour training session with, here's how you're going to get back into IRN.
Independent Radio News, it's 3 minutes past 12.
And we churned out new DJs at the rate of one every hour during Freshers Week, because that's what you had to do. You had to change the entire team every year. And then it was that dependability thing. I always wanted them to believe that although it was a volunteer station, a student station, that we had an audience that deserved our respect. And if you were hungover, you still got up and did your breakfast show at 7 in the morning. And if you didn't, you get a bang on the door from Chris at 7:05. But we also tried to celebrate the success. So I think, you know, you kind of, it's carrot and stick, isn't it? You want to cajole and coach, but you also want to say, hey guys, we're doing an amazing thing here. And I think we did have a great couple of years.
Radio Victory in stereo.
I sent a letter, an old-fashioned letter, on Hall of Residence notepaper during my first year at university to Paul Brown, programme controller of Radio Victory. That was the nearest commercial station to the university in Southampton, so 20 miles down the road in Portsmouth.
I mean, Radio Victory was broadcasting with a transmitter about the size of a Mazda 60-watt light bulb.
It was a straightforward, you know, I'm a keen young radio thing, I can turn my hand to anything, and yes, I could make a cup of tea. Funnily enough, around the 30th anniversary of the close down, I met again his then PA, Tina Miles, who would have written the letter back on an electric typewriter. I can almost recall the words. It said, as it happens, I do have a small task that needs to be undertaken to improve our weekly output. Please make an appointment with Tina to see me.
Radio Victory.
I went to see the great man, Paul Brown. He gave me the task of answering the phones, or setting up the international calls, in fact, for one of these We'll Link You With Your Long-Lost Relative features. I was paid £5 a week. All through that time at university, whatever I was doing, if I was at home back in London, if I was doing a paid job, which I did elsewhere in the vacations, I would always get in the car and drive to Portsmouth. It's a long way to earn £5, a lot more than £5 in petrol, but I wanted them to know that I really meant it. So that was the beginning, tech-opping work. And then a year or so into that, the station had some cutbacks, and they were likely to have to do a pre-recorded programme or something to cut the cost of doing the Saturday night late show. So I said to Paul Brown, I tell you what, I'd really like to have a go at this. I'll do it for free for a while to prove myself, to save you having to make that cut back. They only had one presenter-friendly self-op studio, so he turned up after close down at 1 a.m. to do an audition with me in that studio. I settled in an hour or so later when I'd done my bits with him, presumably listening in the Rax room or something. He came down and said, yeah, I'm going to put you on the radio next Saturday evening. And to this day, I can recall what happened next. We shook hands in the car park, he drove off home, and I drove down to Southsea Castle on the seafront in Portsmouth and sat there on the kind of stonework, gazing out to sea, just thinking, oh my God, this is happening. I'm going to be on a real professional radio station next weekend. And every so often, I go and sit there at Southsea Castle and look out at the Solent and just recall that moment. It was great.
Portsmouth 827755 is the number to call if you'd like to pass a message across to somebody you care for. As ever, if you'd like to say, I love you, thank you, I'm sorry, hello, or even goodbye, you can do it by calling me on Portsmouth 827755. Alan in Hillsborough.
Then got sort of promoted, if you like, while still a student, to do the sports programme Saturday afternoon, which of course was technically very complicated. And then the programme controller changed. Paul Brown was hired by the IBA, and Ian Gilchrist, formerly of Radio 210, turned up as programme controller. And he liked what I did. I've been doing a lot of sort of daytime depping as well as the weekend show. And his first act was to change the breakfast show and offer it to me. So the Monday after I graduated, I became the breakfast jock on Radio Victory.
Radio Victory, the sound of the soul.
Portsmouth is and was a great close-knit community, and it was a great place to work and a bunch of very talented people to work with. And I guess sometimes when you hear people nowadays sort of say, oh, job opportunities aren't like they used to be, you know, there aren't so many of them in commercial radio, I kind of have to remind myself that in those days there were fewer than 30 stations on the dial, and now there's well north of 10 times that many, even though some of them don't employ many presenters. Those of us who were in the industry in those days felt ourselves hugely privileged to be in it. And it was a great buzz.
Argentina has invaded the Falkland Islands, and its marines have taken control of the colony, which has been in British hands for almost 150 years.
It would be a bit cliché to say that Victory had a good war, but it really did. I think people woke up to the special significance of local radio for a community at a time like that. So Portsmouth is the naval city. It's the headquarters of the Royal Navy. And I recall driving over the kind of gap in Portsdown Hill from my university digs on the Sunday when the task force was being assembled, and suddenly looking down into the harbour where you'd normally see, you know, a P&O ferry or two, the thing was like wall to wall with the grey of military hardware of warships. And it, you know, jolted the entire nation, but it really jolted Portsmouth. The station went 24 hours a day during the main part of the conflict. We were live overnight just to keep people up to date with the news. And there is, of course, a famous story of the newsreader, Penny Guy, who I'm still in touch with many years later, who had to read the news of the sinking of HMS Sheffield, knowing that her husband, Derek, was on board. Derek, by the way, survived with nothing but the clothes he stood up in and a cassette tape of Barbara Streisand's greatest hits. Penny carried on through that bulletin, but I think she went home early after that, and, you know, it was an extraordinary moment.
Island to Island, by linking with the Falklands to chat to Charlie Lowndes and pass messages back and forth between family and friends separated by some 8,000 miles of ocean.
So, yes, the Falklands conflict was a huge thing for Victory. Somewhere I have a memo that I sort of photocopied from the one that was pinned up on the board from the then managing director, John Russell, rather beautifully summarising the solemn duty of a local radio station to rise to an occasion like that. And I think Victory really did.
Radio 257, Victory.
It was the autumn of 1985. I was doing the breakfast show, and like most breakfast jocks, I guess, the 8 o'clock news is quite a good moment for a quick comfort break. So I was dashing out of the studio at 8:10, and there outside in the corridor was Ian Gilchrist, the programme controller. And he said, Chris, I want to stop you for a second. I've got some news for you. Well, it's very unusual. He said, we've not got the new franchise. Effectively, he was saying, we're going to be dead within a year. In those days, the deal was that local commercial stations had a fixed-term franchise, and Radio Victory's fixed term was due to end in 1986. So it was re-advertised by the IBA a year earlier. Broadly speaking, it was expected that if you'd kept your nose clean and so on, you know, it wasn't hard to re-win one of these if you were the incumbent. Victory was a very respectable station in those days, though I think in the early days the IBA had regarded it as a bit fly, perhaps is the word, you know, a bit flaky in sort of compliance terms and a bit cheeky, not quite up to the standards they wanted. Paul Brown had sorted that out. It was a very respectable station by then, so would have had a good chance. But in the middle of the process, at a time when the economy was not that hot, the IBA moved the goalposts. They announced that what they were actually going to do was advertise not a licence for Portsmouth and then at some stage later a licence for Southampton. They were going to merge the two and have a licence for South Hampshire and the Isle of Wight and a bit of West Sussex. And that, for a station called Victory, so tied to Portsmouth, kind of wrong-footed it. Suddenly Ocean Sound, which had always had a more sort of pan-regional flavour to it, was better placed to win the licence. There's another famous factoid. I think this is true. It's hearsay. But at a time of uncertain economics, I'm told that Victory's forecast costs were greater than Ocean's forecast revenues. So by definition, one of those was going to be wrong or something was going to go a bit sticky. They chose to go for the more cautious model, the IBA did, and went for the Ocean model. I completed my comfort break and went back on the radio thinking, this has quite a feeling of unreality now. You know, nobody else really knew at that stage. Certainly the listeners didn't know. And there was me being all sort of chirpy, happy good morning, thinking, I've no idea what the future holds.
I heard the news from the authority of our not getting the second franchise. I had to break it, the news, to the staff the following morning, and I did dread that moment, but I needn't have done. The staff were more than magnificent, the way they received the news.
The funny thing about Victory, in retrospect, is that if the audience had showed their enthusiasm during its life half as much as they showed their enthusiasm during its death throes, it might still be here today. I say that because actually the radar performance of Victory was never huge. It was respectable, but it was never huge. And the reaction to the announcement of, you know, the forthcoming close down, and of course to the fact that Portsmouth would no longer have a dedicated radio station because the whole backdrop to this was the merger with the Southampton franchise, the reaction to that was wild. I mean, you know, there were massive petitions raised, there were angry columns in the local paper, which had never been that supportive previously, but suddenly was rowing in right behind us. And when we got to the last programme, there were crowds of people outside the studios in Fratton Road, so large that police had to be called to kind of keep the traffic flowing. We put up some loudspeakers on the porch outside the building so that passers-by could hear the last show, and passers-by really gathered.
Now, madam, what is your name?
Pearl. I'm Pearl, and I live in Leon Solent.
Pearl, you are a warm and wonderful person, because tell everybody back at home what Roger and I will be bringing back, a gift from you, into the studio by about 11:30. This will make their day.
A little bottle of the French champagne.
So, yeah, I think you never know what you've got until it's gone, do you? And I think the people of Portsmouth suddenly woke up to the fact that their local radio, as they saw it then, was about to go.
And will be the first radio station ever to close in the history of British broadcasting, of whom it can be said we didn't fall, we were pushed.
I, by that stage, had cast myself by knocking on the MD's door as the programme controller of the station, because the sort of proper programme controller, along with most of the staff, had already gone by then to their new roles. So the skeleton staff that were left in programming terms were led by me. And I produced the programme and also co-presented it with Pam Spriggs. What we tried to do was a sort of medley of things. We tried to involve listeners by sending the old London taxi radio car shooting around the area to do sort of mini OBs in various places, just taking good luck messages for us, to actually voice up some of the many letters we'd had from listeners, and to summarise as best we could the previous 10 years. So we played the hits of the last 10 years and did little sort of montages of the news themes of the 10-year period. And the whole thing finished with a lovely, very impromptu tribute to the boss, the then boss, Bruce Jenkins, followed by the singing of Auld Lang Syne. And This Will Be Our Last Song Together by Neil Sedaka. I had to argue about that because my former boss had said, no one knows that record. I don't know why you're choosing it. And I said, listen to the lyrics. Just listen to the lyrics.
Days of devils, kings and clowns.
And it was great. A couple of things I should actually say that were not entirely planned. You'll hear that the last commercial is played over the record, which, of course, copyright terms, probably completely illegal. The truth of the matter is I'd forgotten the last commercial was there. I was frantically doing the back timing to get the bongs of the Portsmouth Guildhall clock to strike exactly on time. And I'd back-timed the song and forgotten the advert. So as the song was playing, I suddenly had this cold sweat, turned to the commercial producer and said, is it dry? Is it dry? As in, is there no music behind it? And he said, yeah, it is. So I thought, right, that's my solution. I'll play the darn thing over the song. And we got away with that. The timings did work perfectly. And although there's no way of telling in retrospect, I promise you, that clock did bong dead on midday. The thing finished.
We can say goodbye.
Final announcement, a jingle, and then the silence. And as I talk to you, I can feel this moment now. You know, PPM meters have a sort of delayed action. They respond very slightly slowly to what's going on in life. The jingle stopped, and I stare, because I've been trying to hold it together a lot. Everybody else was blubbing around me, you know, and I've been trying very hard not to. And I stared at those PPM meters, just decay from 6, slowly, slowly, slowly down to 0. And I thought, they're never going to move again. And that's when I went. That's when I just blubbed like a little child. But, yeah, it was an extraordinary day. And then we went down the pub.
Serving southern Hampshire, West Sussex and the Isle of Wight for 10 years, 257 days. This has been Radio Victory.
I was a freelance. My contract had 3 months to run after the close of the station, and to his enormous credit, the late Bruce Jenkins, the managing director then, agreed to honour that on condition that I would make myself available for literally dismantling the studio. So I entered that period not really knowing what was going on, but I'd already opened a flirtation with Ocean, who'd promised at least to interview all the staff of Victory who wanted to work there. I didn't promise jobs, they promised an interview. And I met Michael Betton, the programme controller, in a pub garden near Fareham. Got on with him instantly, actually. It was a bank holiday Monday, I recall, and I'd been doing mid-morning that day. And he'd driven down, me knowing on air that he must be listening. I think he recognised in me a person who, although I was a jock, was also interested in getting the kind of admin side of a radio station right. And we're sort of kindred spirits in that way. We like to sort of, you know, see everything done properly. And so he actually appointed me as a presenter at Ocean to start a couple of weeks before all the other ones and help sort out systems. So I then had effectively a couple of months of the summer off, went on a long holiday, did a bit of freelance work here and there, and ended up at Ocean in the autumn of 1986.
Radio Victory has decided to cease broadcasting in advance of the expiry date of its local radio franchise. From mid-October, the independent local radio service for Portsmouth and Southampton will be provided by a new company, Ocean Sound.
Ocean Sound was a remarkable station. There were lots of extraordinary things about it, but the most extraordinary, I think, was the way the team was built. And I think there are two things I'd want to put on record about this. Number one, we were young and cheap. Nothing wrong with either of those, but it meant we flung ourselves into that radio station. We all worked hard, we played hard, you know, we worked together, half of us ended up in relationships with one another, and it was a very intense time. The other thing about the kind of ethos of Ocean was that in the two top men, they were both men, David Lucas, the MD, and Michael Betton, the programme controller, they were, to use that modern management term, very empowering in the way they did their business. And we, as a young team, we were really hard worked. You know, they got every ounce of flesh from us, but we did it in a kind of intense way and an exuberant way. It was a fantastic time. History shows, of course, that even from the start, Ocean's radar performance was really impressive. I mean, I think it was in the 40s right from the beginning, which for a TSA of more than a million was a good thing to do in those days.
The chairman of Ocean Sound is Philip Pollock.
Good morning. For the very first time, this is Ocean Sound. From this moment on, today and every day, Ocean Sound is your radio station. Through all the seasons of the year, every hour, every minute of the day, we'll be here as your constant companion.
Ocean, where it started, had daytime programmes split. It was slightly counterintuitive. They had a joint breakfast show and then split daytime programmes. And because I had the heritage in the Portsmouth area, I was on Ocean Sound East as the afternoon jock. Now, that actually only lasted for 6 months or so, and then there was a change round of the schedule, and Michael put me on breakfast, which then became the joint programme. So at that point, I also became his deputy. So then I was doing quite a lot of the organising work, as well as getting up early in the morning. And it was a very interesting time for organising work, because 2 years after Ocean started, the old use it or lose it edict came out about AM and FM, and we decided to do that, you know, in a grand way. Ocean split into four stations over a slightly staggered period of time. We used one big transmitter to create Power FM as a youth brand. Then we had Ocean East and sort of North West, based on the Portsmouth and Winchester transmitters, as the heritage ILR style station, and then a gold station using the two medium waves. So suddenly we were producing 48 hours of radio a day from that building, and I did the recruitment for the presenters at a time where the industry was expanding. So I had enormous fun, yeah, scampering all over the industry, finding the brightest and the best for, you know, very different formats.
Sunday, December the 4th, 1988, at exactly 10 a.m. The power is on.
Hilary Osborne from Radio 2 came to work on what eventually became the Easy Listening Channel out of the Winchester transmitter. And at the other end of the scale, we had, you know, young scamps like Chris Kelly from GWR Bath, who came to do tea time on Power FM. But let's just pause for a moment and mention Scott Mills, who came to us straight from Southampton Hospital Radio, where they had told him he was too young to touch the equipment. And I said, you're too talented not to. Get on this radio station quick. So it was his first job in radio, doing the overnights for Ocean.
We start a new week of In Session with a male solo singer from Bournemouth who is about to be quite big. He got his first signing with EMI Records when he was 17.
So it was a wonderful kind of broad church family. You'd have the classical show going out in one studio and the kind of really up-to-the-minute banging tunes coming out of the other. It was a fantastic place to work. For me, I think there are two personal moments. The one is the first Radar after the multi-way split. Bear in mind, this is a big TSA. This is after Radio 1 had gone FM, so it wasn't so easy to amass big Radars in those days as it had been 10 years earlier. I was working at Cows Week, where we used to do an RSL station for the regatta in those days, when the news came through. I was on the barge going out to coordinate the lighting of the fireworks display that is the climax of Cows Week. My old brick of a mobile phone rang, and there was Michael saying, Chris, the Radar result is in, and it's very good. 48% weekly reach, that was such a high feeling. That was amazing. And then the other one for me, I think, is the homecoming of HMS Warrior, which was right back in the early days of Ocean. It was enthusiasm of mine. I love local heritage stories. And this extraordinary Victorian warship, there's a long history to HMS Warrior. It had been lovingly restored by craftsmen up in Hartlepool and was to be bought back to be a star exhibit in the historic dockyard in Portsmouth. And we owned that story. We signed up all the experts. We got all the best vantage points.
There's a ship lies rigged and ready in the harbour.
And one of the things we did was I broadcast the breakfast show live from the deck of the ship as she cast off under tow from the coal dock in Hartlepool. And Pete Wardman, who had a long and glorious career in various places afterwards, including Breakfast on Kiss FM, and is now working for the BBC, he was driving the studio. And we lost cue half an hour before the programme finished. So I had a microphone. I had no idea if he could hear me. I knew I couldn't hear him. I had no return feed, whatever. So we just did this thing where I said to him, right, we've started this song, I can't hear a thing, I'm assuming you can hear me, I think the song is about 2.5 minutes long, so at 38:20, fade the song, I'll talk for 10 seconds, then we'll do this. So doing it all by the clock and guessing how long the items were, we made that programme finish perfectly between us, just by that kind of lovely sense of a bit of teamwork and a bit of telepathy. Then the homecoming of Warrior was just a triumphant thing, and that's one of the tapes I keep. So, yeah, there were some very special people and some very special programmes, and it was a very special set of radio stations.
Well, we have a couple of young people here, fairly young lifetime so far. Alexandra, have you any idea what this ship's going to look like?
Their guns on fire as we sail into hell.
I had spotted the idea that one of the new small stations that the then Radio Authority was going to advertise could be owned in a completely untraditional way. I thought, what is there to stop an individual personally having a controlling stake in a radio business? Answer, nothing. But no one had done it. So when the Salisbury licence came up, I began sort of sniffing around. I didn't know Salisbury at all, but one of our sort of helpers out at Ocean Sound, a man called John Greenstreet, who came and did some feature work for us, was a Salisbury man, and he'd been interested in the licence there as well. So basically, we formed a kind of informal alliance and said, let's explore the idea of applying for it. Subsequently, I got headhunted to be programme controller of 2CR in Bournemouth, and for various reasons, the company, GWR Group, was going through some difficult sort of growing pains, and I didn't really have a happy time there. But as it happens, I went there full of optimism and enthusiasm, and also with this Salisbury idea in the back of my mind. So I'd actually submitted the licence bid to the Radio Authority by the time I arrived at 2CR, but there was a long wait, and the wait dragged on, and I wasn't enjoying 2CR. I left a week before the licence decision was announced, not knowing if I'd have a future. But of course, a week later, I got the call from the Radio Authority. And with that, my life changed in a very big way. Little interesting sort of footnote to that, which is that the Radio Authority officer who called me somehow failed to clear the line when she'd finished talking to me. So she then turned to the other phone and rang a mate of mine who was another applicant. And I could hear the entire conversation that she had with him and then with the people in the office afterwards reporting his reaction. Very strange experience, that. Anyway, that finished. I then rang the chairman, who was a hotelier in Salisbury, who invited me up for a kind of celebration dinner. And my memory of that dinner, it was a very small team. There was a board of, I think, three or four of us and sort of one other sort of key local supporter. We had dinner, and then Michael Maidment, our chairman, asked me to say a few words. So I sort of pushed back the chair, stood up and said, And that was kind of almost all I said. I did say a bit more than that, but my abiding feeling was, oh my God, I've really got to make this happen now, and everyone's looking at me. And, you know, there were things I really didn't understand about how to make radio stations work, which I was going to have to learn really fast.
A Sunday morning, 10 a.m., and at Stonehenge, the first walkers of the day are in tune with the spirit of 5,000 years. A Sunday morning, 10 a.m., and at Hanging Langford, fisherman Paul Knight prepares for a spirited battle with the trout in the River Wye.
I was the majority shareholder, managing director, company secretary, chief engineer, breakfast presenter and deputy head of news. Those are my roles in a team of seven people. But actually that doesn't even cover the thing that I didn't know I didn't know. This is a bit Donald Rumsfeld, isn't it? It was only because my oldest school friend, Mark Bond, persuaded me to take him on as sales manager, and he'd been in radio sales before, actually working for LBC and then for Ocean Sound. It was only because he persuaded me to take him on that I realised we needed a traffic system. You know, I'd never even thought of that before. And so things like traffic and sales ledger and accounts and all that kind of stuff, fundamental to the running of any small business. I didn't know that, but I learnt it. So, yeah, it was a very broad-ranging role. The whole obsession during that phase was to try and actually to focus the spending only on the talented people, and they were talented people. This was a tiny radio station. It was almost, you know, TSA of less than 100,000 by my reckoning. By the authorities' reckoning, it was more like 70,000. No one had done that independently before, I don't think. So people were watching to see if it would work, and I just knew that if I could keep the costs really tight, spend on the people, don't spend on the gas bill, that's the kind of mantra. If I could do that, then I could make it work. You are endlessly thinking of inventive ways round things that other people regard as fixed costs. You're endlessly negotiating with people. If you get that right, then you can relax and enjoy the future. If you get it wrong, you're struggling to get your head above water forevermore. So that was a sort of mark of that phase. The biggest sort of emblem of that phase was the transmitter contract. We were going to build our own transmitter. The then NTL persuaded us that they could take over the site we identified and do it for us and lease it back to us in a kind of standard deal. They then failed to get planning consent, and it was so close to the wire that I actually took Mark, the sales manager, for a walk round the central car park in Salisbury and said, I think we're going to fall. I think we're not going to make our launch date. They were talking about it being, you know, half a year later to rectify the problems. And I said, we're already paying the staff. I think we're going to go bust. Maybe I've got to go back and tell them the game's up. Everyone's lost their jobs. We're not going to do this. He said, keep the faith. Thank God he did. And then I bumped into the engineer from Isle of Wight Radio, who said, don't worry, I'll do it for you. I'll build your transmitter. And I thought, well, I have no choice but to believe this man. And it was like he was heaven sent, because he turned up and literally did it, dug the trench for the mains cable, hired the contractors, put the cabling in, put the wiring in, they built the mast, put the aerial up, and we launched on time, in command of our own finances and in budget. And I will just say one thing as a footnote to that, which is that although I remained the 51% shareholder, just in control, we sold a 20% stake of the minority chunk to GWR. And they were very keen, of course, to be influential in that region and may one day have thought they'd end up owning the station, though in the end, I think ownership rules made it too fiddly for them. But they were very supportive, and one of the things that Ralph Bernard did was to arrange to lend us the money to build the transmitter, and we sort of paid it back on a kind of leasing deal. So, you know, the whole setup was building a sort of defensive little fortress where the outside world couldn't come and take our radio station away. And of course, to this day, Spire FM is still a very prosperous and very local radio station.
The pride of South Wilton,
the spirit of Salisbury. Spire FM.
Good morning. My name's Chris Carnegie, and on behalf of the directors, the staff, and the many friends of your new radio station, welcome for the very first time to Spire FM.
We were profitable from day one, that's the first thing to say, which meant we could then have some fun. You know, we could do ambitious promotions, we could surprise everyone by giving away a car like the big boys did. And the first radar came off the fax machine. I remember John Shorter from How to Rent, who were advising us a little bit about how to handle these things, rang me up and said, it's 43%, Chris. I imagine you'll be quite pleased with that. And I thought, he has a talent for understatement, that man. I was absolutely cock-a-hoop. 43% as a launch, as a debut radar, was wonderful, admittedly in a small TSA. So we were doing big promotions, really, from year one. Of course, at the end of our first full calendar year, we became entitled to submit an entry into the Sony Awards for the small local station of the year. And we won it. And we took the entire team, in fact, in my little acceptance speech, I make a little sort of joke about the fact that Spire was so small we could fit the entire board of directors and the entire station team of that year in question round one table of 10 people. It was a time when the industry generally was a bit miserable. You know, consolidation was leading to downsizing, and, you know, it was all getting a bit not quite as happy-clappy as it had been in the old days. So I made a particular point in my speech of saying, in one sense, we didn't really need this award because we were already the happiest radio station in Britain, but we're even happier now. And we went back on the crest of a wave. And, you know, we did things like having extravagant staff parties, almost like summer balls. I persuaded the Earl of Pembroke to give us the grounds of Wilton House one year to put a marquee up in. And, you know, we would always celebrate Radjar because it was always there to be celebrated. So it was an extraordinarily happy time. And the other thing I suppose to say about those days is that, picking up my cue from the way the management of Ocean Sound had behaved, I was really keen to be, to use that word again, empowering. You know, we hired talented people and we let them get on with it and contribute their ideas. And if somebody came in with a brilliant idea at breakfast, we'd executed it by tea time and just said, yeah, let's do it, let's do it. So that was a distinctive and happy thing about Spire, I think. And of course, famously, a lot of the launch team from Spire went on to extraordinary things. Somebody once said to me that all it takes to run a radio station is five people who get it.
102.
It was 3 years after Spire started that Robert Stibe came into my life. Robert is one of the icons of the radio industry. He was the visionary who put together a consortium to acquire the press stake in Capital Radio, given a choice between Capital and LBC, and his press colleagues said, surely we go for the news station, and he said, I've got a hunch that Capital will make more money. And he was right, of course. Robert was a radio entrepreneur. He was what you'd call now, I suppose, a sort of private equity operator in the radio industry. And he owned, by this stage, Island FM in Guernsey, and he also owned a couple of stations on the mainland that weren't doing so well, KCBC in Kettering, and what was then called Boss 603 in Cheltenham. Now, he had the idea of forming a specialist operating group for smaller stations, and he came to me and offered to buy Spire FM and put me in charge of it. So that's the birth of the local radio company. I thought of the name, and it was headquartered initially in my back bedroom, and we started off with KCBC, Cheltenham Radio, Spire FM, Spire FM's sister station in Shaftesbury, which we'd launched earlier that year. That was Gold Radio, serving North Dorset.
Welcome to Gold Radio from all the team who've worked so hard to bring local radio to a very special part of Britain. And before we go any further, I've got one or two people to say thank you to Christine Manley and the officers and members of the Radio Authority who literally made it possible. To Mike Lancaster and the team from Mouldings who built our studios in...
So we had those four, and then GWR, who came in with a chunk of the TLRC group, transferred Isle of Wight Radio into it. And that was a fascinating challenge. So suddenly I'm running a group of stations. I handed the running of Spire over to Ian Axton, who had joined us shortly after the launch and drove it to new heights and actually... eventually followed me as group chief exec as well, and is now ITV's anchor on the news in the West Country. But moving on from just running Spire to running the group was a very different phase of life. I was in the car a lot. You know, some days I would get up, drive from Salisbury, where I live, to Lowestoft, where we ended up having a key stake in the beach, and back again. And, you know, it was a slightly mad existence. But within about 3 years, we built the TLRC and Robert Stibe's radio investments empire between them to have stakes in 28 radio stations spread between Stirling in Scotland, Plymouth in the southwest, and doing the diagonal the other way, I suppose you'd go from Lowestoft in the east, certainly to Cheltenham in the west. You know, it was a ridiculously fast pace of growth, probably faster than we should have tried, actually, because not all of these stations worked. But we tried to do it in that reasonably idealistic way of locally empowered programmers and common sense mathematics on the kind of business model. We won a bunch of licenses. The period I'm talking about now, by the way, is basically leading up to the millennium, so kind of 96 to 2000. And it was just frantic. I keep, still to this day, I run my life with an A4 paper diary. I just find it really easy to keep notes of meetings and to, you know what I'm doing in those books. I keep them all. And you can look at them on the shelf, and the ones that have been patched up with sticky tape and are really sort of ragged are the ones where they were really busy years and I was just flinging my stuff from place to place. And 1999 in particular is a really ragged diary, but by heavens it's interesting. When I look back through that, I realise that I've no idea how I kept the pace up. I really don't. Actually, the job of just being a suit who toured the country only doing commercial deals and legal and accountancy work, effectively, was beginning to become a little less appealing. And I'd seen the opportunity to apply in my own right for the station under the Sally licensing regime, the small-scale station in Southampton. We won the licence. I tendered my resignation from TLRC. And as chief exec, you know, you have quite a long notice period. And believe it or not, I worked every day of a 12-month notice period and left on very good terms. It worked out fine. I went to South City FM, which had already launched by that stage. A friend of mine and former colleague called Claire Carson had been the launch manager. Station had started. But I joined full-time as breakfast presenter. And then Claire decided to move on a few months later, so I took over as manager director as well. And that, bizarrely, was quite a happy time, even though it wasn't a great success of a radio station. You know, we managed to build the audience little by little, but never really made any money out of it. It was gently draining me month after month. Eventually, I thought, it's not going to pay my wages, this station. I took a job at the BBC World Service, presenting their business programme. Thoroughly enjoyed that. Completely different. Full-time job in journalistic speech programming. First time I'd ever done that. Still owned South City FM, but in the middle of that period sold it to Southampton Football Club. And that was a searing experience. I had to walk in to South City FM, hold a staff meeting, and tell them the news. And normally when you tell people a radio station's been taken over, they feel a little frisson of nervousness. But on this occasion, I was telling them that it had been taken over by somebody who already had a completely staffed digital radio station and just wanted to put that output on our transmitter. So the implication of that was pretty obvious.
All right, we just had some special guests in, Dave Jewson and Gary Chalk, and I'm delighted to say we've got two other special guests. They're working on a new DVD, a Saints DVD. Let's say hello to...
They didn't need studios, they didn't need most of our staff. And you can imagine it was just the most stomach-churning, terrifying thing to have to do. And of course, people took it with enormous dignity. The only person who really had a go at me, actually, and she was completely right, was our news editor, who simply said to me, if you've been losing money all that time, why didn't you tell us earlier? Maybe we could have helped. Maybe we could have planned our own lives better. I chose to internalise the problems and just try and deal with them and not spread any gloom, because I don't like spreading gloom. But she was right about that. But overall, everybody was lovely, and we made sure they were all looked after financially. And as it happens, times were good in the radio industry. They all got jobs within 10 days of the closure of South City FM. So that was that phase. That left me as a BBC presenter journalist, which I did for a while, and then got the usual itchy feet, left to do a kind of odd collection of jobs, which were huge fun. I launched the community radio station in Portsmouth, where I'm still involved, sort of one day a month as the company secretary and head of regulatory things. It's a great station, does really ambitious stuff in the community world. It's called Express FM. I then did a whole bunch of reporting, feature-making work for the new regional station in the south, which was called Original 106 in those days. I worked from home. I wasn't really involved in the life of the station, but just toured the area doing OB inserts and had an absolute ball. They sent me on a trip to South Africa to do a series of features, a trip to the Falklands to do a series of features.
From Monday on Original 106, hear the South's heroes of the South Atlantic.
You're frightened of death, and you're frightened that she won't be brave.
The men who trained in Poole, who sailed from Portsmouth and Southampton.
It was huge fun, but even at the time I thought, I can't see how this makes sense for anyone financially, and of course, famously, it didn't. And then, after helping Ian Axton, the man who'd taken over Spire from me, and by that stage was a TV man, really, I helped him to launch Andover Sound. I was, again, his company secretary and did a bit of legal work for him and had a small stake in the company and sort of commissioned the studios. I physically helped build the studios, actually, did some of the wiring and got my brother-in-law to do the partitions. Amazing. By the way, historical note, it was about the early 2000s, and we built the entire radio station, including its transmitter, two air-conditioned studios, the central apparatus room, all the office IT, the office furniture, and an OB rig for 28,000 quid. You know, I sometimes look at the money that gets spent, and it was lovely, by the way. It was great to work with and felt quite swish. But we worked really hard on that. I helped Ian launch Andover Sound, and that kind of inspired me to think, yes, the magic is still achievable. You can still do small-scale local radio. And you know, every car park was full of Andover Sound stickers in that town. It was like the glory days of ILR all over again, and it was in the 2000s. That inspired me to take a bit of a punt when the then-owners of TLRC rang up and said, did I want to buy two stations in the midwest of the country, in Yeovil and Shaftesbury? And I said, yes. They, of course, were stations that were financially extremely challenged, but I thought, God, I'm feeling really excited about this. I can do it. And that's how the Midwest Radio episode started. It only lasted a year, but it was a year in which the world collapsed financially. I was personally funding the wages of the staff every month. And one morning I woke up and thought, I must lend the company some more money. I must get it from my Ice Save account. Turned the radio on, and the bank where my money was had gone bankrupt.
He was moving to reassure everybody in Iceland that their deposits are safe, that the krona was now stabilised, and he was giving details about the fact that the second biggest bank in Iceland, Landsbanki, has been nationalised.
And you don't plan for that. You write business plans with sort of variables in them. You don't plan on your bank going bust and your money disappearing. So that was a test of nerve. I have to say, thanks to Gordon Brown, all us personal savers in Icelandic banks got our money back at Christmas. So that was a mighty relief. But I walked in that day and the newsreader was kind of joshing. He said, hey, have you seen this, Chris? There's a bank that's gone bust. How does that ever happen? And I thought, if you knew your wages were in that bank, Robbie, you wouldn't be laughing about it. But again, I kind of internalised that and just smiled and carried on. And it all worked out in the end. Looking back on Midwest, that was too ambitious. I tried to do it really on my own. I was the 100% owner of that business. It had been extremely financially challenged, and turning it round required me to work in a slightly manic way, sort of 20 hours a day for about 6 months. You know, I was doing all the office work in the night and going to try and G people up during the day at the stations. And, you know, there were times when I woke up literally in a cold sweat at 3 a.m, thinking, how am I going to pay the VAT bill later on today? But actually, the irony of this story is that if you look at the history financially, we turned it round. We missed the iceberg. The stations were actually between them making a very small profit within 6 or 7 months of me acquiring them. But actually, I have to be honest and say I realised the emotional cost of carrying all that on my shoulders, which it was a cost I'd chosen to bear, but it was getting too much. So again, I found a West Country entrepreneur who wanted to buy the stations, sold them at a effectively modest loss, and we really are talking about handfuls of thousands of pounds changing hands, and took the job of managing editor of BBC Radio Solent. I say took, I applied for it from the office of the solicitor where the deal to sell Midwest Radio was happening. I said, can I borrow your machine? Now I know that I've sold this company and can walk away with a clear conscience. Can I borrow your machine to hit the go button on my BBC application?
Loving life in the South.
Southampton.
This is BBC Radio Solent.
So, on the way...
I knew Radio Solent had had a difficult patch. It had been one of the glory stations of the BBC local radio network, but had famously gone through a crisis where there was a media storm about an alleged ageism comment that had been made. Alleged, by the way, it was overcooked by the press, who were, as ever, having a field day against the BBC. So it was in a difficult time. The figures had been in free fall for a while. People, I don't think it's controversial to say they were demoralised. You know, they were almost worried about going to public events because the public didn't like them, they thought. So it needed moving round. I decided that you couldn't do anything too explosive with the station. I wasn't going to suddenly sort of detonate the whole thing and change the entire schedule and rebrand or something, because essentially, I thought, at heart, that amazing heritage and the goodwill and the love for the area that the team had would show through. So in my head, I said, I've got to hug this station better. I can't sort of shove it better. I have to hug it better. I just have to try and inject as much positivity and optimism into it as possible. But of course, the truth is, I had no idea about the workings of the BBC. I'd worked as a broadcaster for the World Service, but in terms of getting things done at management level and the sort of constraints and the guidelines and the rules and the extraordinary level of public scrutiny, which was probably reaching its peak at that stage where the BBC was a target for all kinds of critics. The level of public scrutiny, the constraints in terms of staffing structures and procedures with which you work seemed to me daunting then, but that's partly because I'd come to them in midlife. If I'd grown up with them, it wouldn't have seemed daunting, and to be honest, it doesn't seem that daunting now. I kind of think maybe I was a bit more overwhelmed by it then than I need have been. I'm having enormous fun now. I could have gurgled with delight when I think about it, but the funny thing is that very little of it is in mainstream radio. I do bits of radio now. I'm still involved with a community radio station. I'm still involved with a couple of RSLs every year, including presenting on the Cowes Week Regatta station, where I think this year will mark my 29th or 30th year in a row of doing that. So that's great.
Stay tuned to Cowes Radio for all the action on and off the water.
But I've got two other big things in my life now. I still work part-time for the BBC, and I run the BBC's relationship with the new emerging local TV stations. And going around the country, signing contracts with them and being as encouraging to them as I can is great, because it reminds me of all the adrenaline and the fizz and the optimism of any launch phase in a business like that. So that's huge fun. And then in the other half of my week, I think I mentioned to you that I'd been to the Falklands, and subsequently I sent myself on a holiday from the BBC to a little island in the South Atlantic called Tristan da Cunha, the remotest settlement on the planet. And through a series of events that began with that radio trip, I've now become their sort of honorary consul in the UK, and I get to do some really interesting work on sort of partly helping out islanders when they come to the UK, but also representing the island in the UK. So I'm learning stuff from, you know, fishery management rules to health service quotas to Lord knows what else, and, you know, being the face in the UK to government departments and so on and so forth of that tiny community. And it feels like a special responsibility and a special treat to be learning new things in midlife. So, yeah, I'm absolutely having fun. The honest truth is, I don't regret anything for myself in terms of the way my career turned out. I think there are a couple of times where there were as it were, nettles I should have grasped earlier. I should have seen radio stations that had problems or individual people who had problems and not just been so busy running around trying to spin a million plates that I should have attended to them sooner and in a more full way. But in terms of the span of my radio career, I still feel like I felt that day on the seafront in Southsea next to Southsea Castle. Just incredibly lucky to have experienced this because, you know, I've lived through the boom years of ILR at a time when everybody wanted to know you if you were in commercial radio, and it was that passport to go anywhere. You know, put a microphone in your hand and you can meet anybody, ask them anything, learn anything, have any experience you want.
It's cold outside from Radio Victory, and welcome to the Midnight Love Affair.
It's been a fantastic, fantastic privilege.
OK, so we're on the sixth floor of the BBC.
I'm going to make a confession to you now, which is that when I first saw Scott Mills' autobiography appear on the bookshelves, of course, I went straight out to Smith's, and before I even bought it, I looked up my name in the index. And there's a lovely bit about me offering Scott his first job in radio and just being supportive of him in those early years where, as he describes in the book, he wasn't a very confident guy. I think if I've given a few people the confidence to realise what they could achieve, then that's, well, that's what the job is, isn't it? That's what running radio stations is or should be about. So if I've done that, that's great.